Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's September 6, 2019. You're listening to the greatest PokerCast ever invented. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
I have a question for you. When you're talking about a poker's winnings, like a poker player's winnings, does it really matter?
I think that was going to be my answer to what we were going to talk about first in the show. And I agree. Yes, it doesn't really matter. Well, I mean, I guess in a sense it matters. And I guess we can get into that. But I kind of like how I troubleshoot problems in my own life.
Right.
If I get to a point where I'm like, there's not a solution, then I quit worrying about it.
Man, that's a great way to look at life.
I just do the best I can, right? I mean, why am I going to stress myself out over trying to come up with a solution that doesn't exist, right?
Yeah, all right, so you just launch into our first item. It's just last night I was looking over the file, what we're going to talk about today, and when I finished reading it, I thought to myself, why? And why does it matter? And I know I'm not trying to, like, put the cart before the horse or anything. I'm just saying, and I just thought, why do a lot of things matter?
Oh, no.
But I'm not going to go there in the show today. But this is just an interesting thing to me because I thought it really has no effect on anything in life. Why are they giving it so much weight? But
well, it technically does have a little influence in life. I mean, granted, I mean, in poker life, not real life, you know.
Yeah.
Very poker actually has anything to do with real life, right? We're all kids playing a game, right? But all right, anyhow, so what we're talking about is there's an ongoing debate in the poker world that recently resurfaced over what, if anything, can be done to more accurately report players' true winnings. The Hendon Mob and other reporting sites show you how much a player has grossed over their career but does not report tournaments the players entered but didn't cash, or how many bullets a player fired to get that big score. In a Poker News article about this, Matthew Waxman put forth maybe the only realistic way to accomplish this on a tour-to-tour or casino-by-casino basis by using a player of the year formula.
Okay, so obviously my argument here was that, let's say if it's to influence player of the year accolades or something, first of all, the person or the entity giving out the player of the year award would have its own system in place anyway, so the reporting of them...
Well, that's what Waxman's saying, yes.
Yeah, so...
And that little bubble, we can make this work. But outside that little bubble,
and I just don't see why it matters that I have three caches on Hendon Mob and it doesn't have the buy-in for me or what I bought. You know, I just don't see why that. I don't see how it matters. I don't see. Plus, your winnings, all it is tournament winnings anyway. It doesn't mean how much that player's made in his life. First of all, he could be playing online, and it's not on there. Second of all, he could be playing cash games, and that's not on there. Third of all, he could play private games. Who cares? Why does anybody care how much someone's won? And why does it need to be a true report? What is it that you're benefiting from a true report? I don't get it.
All right.
Help me out. Man, help me. That's why I bring it up to you, because I know you can help
me. So to that extent, I get in terms of, a couple of reasons. One, player backing, player staking probably has a big deal. If I say I have $1 million in cash winnings and you say you have $25,000 in cash winnings, but I spent $2 million to win my million and you spent $2,000 to win your $25,000,
right?
Who's the player that's better to back, right? You would be in that case, right? So,
yeah.
So to that extent, that's kind of important, but that's also kind of a private thing.
Yeah, that's got nothing to do with. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that if you're going to be a backer, it's on you to decide. It's not up to Hendon Mob to go deep into the bowels of rebuys. to say, hey, this guy's worth backing. It's still, I still don't get it. Okay, so keep going.
Well, yeah, I think on a bigger scale, it's more of an ego thing, which, again, probably is not that big a deal. We don't really care whose ego is what, right? Yeah. You know, you kind of look at this like it's kind of ridiculous, and folks really don't focus on this anymore. But, like, the players who have the most tournament winnings in a career, right? It's if you win the World Series main event, you're automatically in the top 10, not top five, and you may not do anything the rest of your career, right? So. And then you have folks like, you know, Danny Negreanu, who are out there winning stuff, you know, consistently for 10, 15 years now, right? So there is a little bit of an ego thing there. But where that translates into money, I think, it's part of the reason this keeps coming up is, you know, endorsements, kind of fame in the poker world, right? You know, we have a lot of these players that we think are very, very good players because we've seen them on TV and they have big scores. But then we hear later they're flat broke, right? So, how are those folks being the ones that are being, you know, hoisted up on shoulders on TV when we have probably some really strong grinders at home that are very disciplined with their money and probably have never been a losing player in their whole life, right? They just don't have that big score, that one big score, but they've consistently cash and cash with a good ROI. So,
well, see, again, and I don't mean to harp on this, but again, that really doesn't make sense either to me, in the sense that if it's sponsorships and everything, these people who are looking to sponsor people, whether it's where are their logo or whatever, they're going to be on site, and when the people make the feature table or the final table, they're going to make their deals then. That's one. Two, if it's going to be the long-term deals like a Daniel Negreanu with Stars, however long he was with them, then you're going to know that this player is a quality player, because you're going to even see – if they are making final tables and their listings of their tournaments and you see they've made 10 final tables last year at major events, it doesn't matter what the true winnings were. It makes zero sense, because all these people look for is exposure. And if they're going to get to a final table, no matter what path they took, they're still going to get you a ton of exposure with their logo. So – again, the true winnings thing, it makes zero sense to me that you have to have an accurate report of how much people are making on the tournament scene of all places. Like, when these people go broke that you mentioned, most of them are going broke because they have a problem outside of poker, like gambling and loans and, you know, cash game. You know, they suck at cash games. And so it's like, you're still not going to find out that they have these leaks in their private life or in their other, you know, vices. So you're still not going to get an accurate report of what a person has in the bank. It's just a weird topic for someone to write an article about and for people to care about. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, again, remember when we started the show, most of our listeners were math nerds, right?
Yeah.
They might still be. And to those folks, and I'm not making fun of them, but I'm saying, in the world they live in, everything is logical, right? Everything has a reason. It's a series of zeros and ones, and it all comes out, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's probably part of what's pushing this. I mean, it may not be all of it, but I think, you know, there's just this innate part of us that wants things to be correct and be right and be exactly what they should be, right? So, I mean, it's the same reason that we go to a bar and you hear people argue over who the greatest quarterback in the NFL is, right? You're never going to win that argument. That argument is unquantifiable, right? He's got 17 Super Bowl rings. And I'm like, well, all right. And, you know, all that stuff, you know, it all depends on what you think is what's more important, right? So, but it's fun to have the debate, right? So, for some people.
See, now, for me to relate to that, you need to take the word bar out and put in bonsai meeting.
That's right.
And then say, instead of a bonsai meeting, instead of greatest quarterback, you got to say greatest, you know, artist or, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you if you guys have a lot of football discussions breaking out at the bonsai conference.
We do, actually. We do. No, but you're right. It's just like comparing eras and things like that. The other thing, too, is a lot of these places don't report their tournament. Like results.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing, too. There's never going to be a complete reporting anyhow. I mean, and one of the big misses that we always talk about is cash games are never recorded. And, I mean, no one would ever want you to record a cash game, right?
Nor could they.
Probably 90% of poker players don't pay taxes on their cash winnings, if not more than that, right? Yeah. So you started doing that, and they're like, whoa, hey, we're all We're pretty cool about people not knowing everything. Yeah.
We're all right with the untrue winnings.
But yeah, so I think your point, I think it's just, you know, a good good barroom discussion or bonsai convention meeting discussion. And again, it can't be solved. I mean, we said that from the beginning, and everybody involved in here says that there's no way it could be solved. So the best thing is, and I kind of agree, I mean, that's why I put that, what Waxman said on there, like in a small frame of time, you probably can figure out the player who did the best there. But again, I mean, even those criteria are subjective, right? Like, I mean, because no player of the year formula factors in number of buy-ins, I don't think, or how many events you entered and didn't cash. I mean, it can, that's possible. Those things exist. Whether players are fine with that coming out is a different story, but, you know, even that, I'm like, then you can have an argument over style. Like, you know, if you were entering a rebuy tournament, there's probably a bunch of poker players that say your best strategy is to come in with 10 bullets.
Yep.
And if you don't come with 10 bullets, then you're not being strategic enough, even if you don't use those other 9. So, you know, if you go through 9 and still cash, but that's part of your strategy, does that make you a worse player than somebody that cashed that only did 1 bullet?
Right.
You know, again, now we're back in the barroom in the cafeteria of the bonsai event.
I guarantee you there is not one casino out there that is going to say, all right, let's keep track of all the players who didn't cash and send that information to Hendon Mob, and let's keep track of how many rebuys people did. You know, most of the time, rebuy tournaments, too, you don't even know who the person is. They're sitting at the table, and they're handing the dealer money, and then, you know what I mean, or the, you know, they're bringing a floor over real quick and giving them the 100 or something. It doesn't work out that way. They're not going to start putting little hash marks, you know, on the wall to keep track of Matt Waxman's buy-ins and, you know.
Well, in rebuys, you're right, but in re-entries, you would. I mean, if you have the Bravo system, all that stuff is tracked. So they know exactly how many.
Yeah.
I mean, the operator knows exactly how much money you've put into that tournament or how many tournaments you put in a cash. But again, there doesn't seem to be any reason why they would be the ones pushing this. But if there's a group of players that came out and said, hey, we really want to know who the best player at the Antioch World Championship is, and these are all the factors that we consider important. And I mean, you could talk a venue maybe into doing that, but again, I don't see it being that big of an issue that we get to that point.
Can you imagine Hendon Mob getting a list of 17,000 names and having to put it in and say, these are the guys who didn't cash, give them a -5 score today? Or, yeah. I mean, just that would be just.
But admit this, you would love to know. I mean, I do this all the time with all kinds of things. So I'm just like randomly walking around thinking about things. You just want to know the person in the world that has done the most X, right?
Yeah.
Whatever it is, fill it in the blank, you know. Been to the most countries, ridden the most roller coasters, whatever, you know?
Right.
And it's impossible to figure that out, but you're just like, you have natural curiosity. I mean, I would love to know what that number is, right? And I think we would all be lying if we didn't say we would love to know the person who lost the most money playing poker in their career. Wouldn't that be just, I mean, and what that number would be? I mean, I can't even guess what that number would be. It's
probably somebody in our home game.
Tens of millions, probably?
Yeah. No, I know. It could be the most wealthy people who just enter to have fun and don't care, but yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. How much they've lost? I don't know. I just, I'm glad we had something to talk about, but to me, it just.
See, we turned nothing into talking.
Yeah, we turned nothing into the podcast. That's our show, yeah. Or like the Seinfeld PokerCast.
All right, I meant to mention this last month when I was up at the World Championship, and our good friend Matt Savage mentioned it to me, but I forgot. But now there's some discussion about it, so we'll talk about it now. So tournament director Matt Savage likes to be on the cutting edge of tournament innovation. But what do we think about his latest idea, The Abyss? First of all, I love the name, but anyhow, it debuted last month at Commerce Casino, where most of his crazy ideas debut. And for the entire time that registration is open, which was the entire 8-hour first day and the first 2 hours of the second day, the blinds never increase.
They should rename the tournament Chapter 11, because that's what a casino will have to file if it has too many of these tournaments. I mean, it's pretty serious. So when I think about, I read the article, and it was like, I mean, yeah, it's like the deepest tournament like possible, really. And I don't know. Some people don't like that, too. Some people want people to feel the pressure of having to shove and how do you make money? The whole point of tournaments is to get them to bankrupt and go play cash games or get them in the building. Now you're keeping them in the building for a day and a half without making any money on them. You know?
Well, I think that's what's interesting. I mean, this article was written before the whole tournament ended, but out of 100 and some entries on the first day, they 27 bags, so which is not too far out of the norm for a tournament. So I think that's what's interesting is that people still go broke in a event where they should not go broke. You know, if you're playing properly, unless you're getting coolered, you really should not get eliminated from this tournament on the first day, right? because there's no pressure on you to play a wider range of hands or take a shot on those coin flips or that when, you know, you're always deep, right? So, right. But human nature and poker nature makes people do that anyhow. So I think that's from the mad scientist on the outside looking in the glass window of this Frankenstein's monster. That's what's fascinating to me is that players still find a way to lose chips even when there's no pressure on them to lose chips. And a lot of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, coolers happen and people get bored and boredom happens. So,
well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So yeah. I'm set in. And then, so even though the blinds were going up, people were still getting eliminated. And they shouldn't. You really shouldn't in this kind of format, right? Coolers are really the only way you should be eliminated on the first day in this format. Yeah. Any other reason, it's because you're getting squirrely or bored or
discipline.
Whatever. So, yeah. Yeah. You know.
The other thing I thought about too, or even mentions it in the story, I think, was that they have no chance of hitting the guarantee unless they somehow got 1,000 people the last day and a half. And it's like you can't put a guarantee on the abyss. I mean, you just can't.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know what the procedures are there where they put a guarantee on every event they might, but you know, you also put a guarantee on an event to get people excited about it. And when you do a new event, you need to do something to get people to try it. Cause you know, again, most poker players will look at something new and go, yeah, we'll wait until you work out the kinks.
Well, they even admitted it's a one and done. I mean, unless, you know, somebody wants to have fun and try it again, just because they wanted some sort of a marketing scheme to get people in the door. But yeah, this doesn't have a realistic chance. Although what's funny is it kind of gets back to you and I, every once in a while we'll have the topic on the show of, you know, these guarantees are getting out of hand and we need to have that happy medium between guarantee and, you know, people to rebuys, no more re-entries and all that. So this kind of, you know, gets to, hey, you want to play for as long as you can for, you know, without any pressure or anybody rebuying, because they're not going to rebuy or re-enter because they're going to still be here the second day. You know, it kind of solves that problem, but then it just makes it even worse for the
casino. But here's another interesting thing that this solves is there's no reason not to re-enter this tournament or enter it as late as possible.
Right.
Almost no reason. I mean, obviously people have built up stacks and stuff, so you need to worry about that. But, you know, I mean, you know, think about it. Every time you get knocked out of a tournament and it's still re-entry time, what's the first thing you do if you feel like playing? You look up and you look at the blinds and the starting stack and you figure out how many big blinds you're going to have. And then you're like, whoa, I'm going to buy in for 10 big blinds? No, forget that. Or I'm buying in for 30 big blinds? Okay, I'll buy in again. Here, you're always buying in for a big stack. So really, you don't lose those players as the tournament goes on in terms of re-entry. So theoretically, you should have people that if they do get cooler, which we mentioned happens, or for whatever reason they get undisciplined and then they slap themselves in the face and they say, all right, I'm going to do better next time. There's that should be no reason for them not to re-enter this event. So you do churn people a little bit better than you would do in a normal tournament on that. So that's that argument.
You could literally show up for the tournament, get cooler in the first hour, go home, watch a movie, have lunch, think about it, go back and re-enter.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, even the next day.
The only thing given up at that point is, again, chip accumulation from some other people. But in terms of actual blinds and your chip and your starting stack, you're golden.
I mean, I could see Helmuth showing up on day two because the way he does it. You know, there's no reason to show up on time. You just...
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing about this tournament. I mean, there's some strategy involved in knowing how you play, right? So, you know, if you are a little timid and you know you need to accumulate chips in order to win a tournament, then you're going to buy in the first day, the first hour, and hope you make it.
Yeah.
If you're that that ADD person that can't pay attention for 8 hours without anything to stimulate you, like increasing blinds, there'd be absolutely no reason for you to register on the first day. You'd come the second day and register in the first 2 hours, right?
Yep.
So,
interesting. Yeah,
so interesting. That, it's kind of an interesting tournament in a lot of ways. But, yeah, in terms of practice, I mean, I guess we'll have to see if it's not one and done, you know, how it develops from there. But in theory, there's a lot of stuff to like about it and a lot of stuff to scratch your head about.
Yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so last night I rocked out to my boy Sebastian Bach, so I thought this would be an interesting thing to throw on the show. The website Metal Injection, which, by the way, I'd never heard of until this, so it's a little harder metal than my metal. So anyhow, the website Metal Injection asks, what is the best song about poker ever written? And, of course, their list skews closer to the heavier songs, but its finalists were The Clash's The Card Sheet, OAR's That Was a Crazy Game of Poker, AC/DC's The Jack, Grateful Dead's The Deal, and Motorhead's Ace of Spades, with Motorhead reigning over all of them. So I know you're interested about this because not necessarily your poker song, and maybe not everybody's poker song. So.
Well, it's funny because I thought to myself, well, there's a couple of songs there I don't know, or if I did know them, I didn't realize I knew them, or, you know, whatever. So instead of listening to them all, because, you know, really, I don't even know how I would do that. They give you a little sample of it on there, but they don't give you the whole song. But I'm not going to buy all these songs. So, I mean, I listened to a couple of them, and then a couple of them I just read the lyrics. And it's funny that some of these songs are even considered poker songs, you know, because they mention, you know, one line about it, or, you know, one phrase about a poker game, and all of a sudden the whole song's about poker. And it's not. So I'm obviously going to be partial to OAR's That Was a Crazy Game of Poker, because that is sort of nostalgia for us. It's when the show kind of got going and they had the whole Heads Up Championship, which is why we listened to the song in the first place on NBC. And, you know, when I was growing up, I listened to AC/DC a lot. So, and of course, everyone loves Motorhead's Ace of Spades, but it's just, it's weird to call it a poker song. But I don't. Obviously, there are other songs about poker that we like that aren't in here.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like Kenny Rogers, The Gambler. But
yeah, exactly.
But you're up on the website, Metal Injection.
Metal Injection. Of course, I don't know how you'd put OAR's song in Metal Injection either.
Yeah,
but
I always think, I mean, here's probably what's going on in the writers' meeting in this. They're like, okay, we get Mob. Yeah, The Jack, that's awesome. The card sheet, perfect. Hey, do you think this song that's actually about poker that everybody knows should be on the list? Oh, that's not metal.
Or they're like, we can only come up with three songs. We're really going to do this for a story. Let's open up the landscape here a little bit and include OAR, because there's not enough songs here that actually fit in Metal Injection. I don't know. I mean, everyone likes the Ace of Spades. I mean, you like that song. And if you're saying, if it is about poker, then yeah, you know, then that probably should reign, especially on a website like this. But yeah, I'm always partial to the OAR song.
I think, you know, if you're asking me a song that I have to listen to over and over, obviously Ace of Spades is going to be it in terms of poker, though the best poker song here is OAR's. Yeah. It may not be the best song, but it's certainly in the top five of anybody's list, I would think. I mean, I can't imagine any legitimate person trying to rank poker songs and not have that in their top five, right?
So, yeah.
Because it's just clearly about poker where these other ones are. I mean, that's what was funny about AC/DC. They're talking about the Jack is all euphemisms.
It's
all using cards, but that's not what it's about, folks.
That's right. when I think of OAR, too, I often remember when we used to have the home game where it was tournaments, and we had everyone from, like, the Times come and hang out with us and play poker tournaments, and you and I would clean up. But one time, one of us, I think it might have been me, I had a mix going. We had it one of the few times we had it at my house. And I had a mix going of songs, and that song came on. And you turned to Laura, and you're like, this is that song. This is that song. Listen to it, Laura. It's really good. And she looked at you like, yeah, it's not Wilco. I'm not listening to this song. And you're like, no, but isn't it really good? And she's like, yeah, Scott, let's just deal, will you? You know, it was pretty funny.
Yeah, and Wilco does have a song called Casino Queen. So
see, there you go. I should have put that in the mix for her.
Everybody dabbles in it at some point. So
we all dabble. All right, any updates? AntyUpMagazine.com has a more modern, sleek, and easier-to-navigate look and feel Plus, it's mobile friendly now. Really cool on the iPhone. Check it out and let us know anything we can do to improve it. If you'd like to be one of our monthly magazine contributors and represent AntiUp in your home area, apply at antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors. We have immediate openings in the Pacific Northwest and Michigan. Also, join the AntiUp Fans Group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands, ask call the floor questions, or just discuss anything poker. Go to Facebook and search for AntiUp Fans. Each week, we spotlight a listener who emails us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we'll send them something really cool. Comes from Vinny Ferrigno. He says, I've recently played in a few local Texas card houses. When a guarantee isn't going to get met, I see staff like dealers and managers jump into play. Most recently, there was a $1,500 guarantee and a $100 buy-in tournament. And we only had 13 players with less than 20 minutes left in the registration period, and a dealer and a manager bought in. I know that dealers are probably on their own dime, but the managers probably have a vested interest in the guarantee not being met. Should it be allowed for them to play in this situation? The short answer, absolutely.
Well, absolutely with an asterisk. So
yeah,
what I told Vinny is, what you need to find out is whether these players are playing with their own money or house money. So it's a different story to me if they're playing with house money. You know, if a dealer buys in with his own money, he's a player. I mean, it doesn't matter whether he works there or not.
Right.
You know, if the rules allow them to play, that's fine. I can't say I've ever seen managers jump in to play at the last minute, but, you know, these Texas card houses are a little bit different animal than casinos. So that may be acceptable there, may not be acceptable. Kind of depends on the players to decide that. But yeah, if you have a guarantee and you miss and you're taking house money, which I don't really know how that would work, to make sure you don't have a guarantee, that's kind of a way of reneging on the guarantee, even though you put a player and then I have to beat. So I would have a little bit of problem with that. But otherwise, I would imagine these folks are buying with their own money at that point. Yeah, it's an overlay, so they're trying to take advantage of the overlay. It doesn't really save the company any money, really, I guess. And, you know, something I was discussing with a player last month somewhere, too, and I'm like, you talk to really good poker room managers, they don't mind missing a guarantee from time to time. They don't want to miss it big, don't get me wrong, but they don't mind missing it by a little bit because if you miss it by a little bit, if you never miss your guarantees, you're obviously not setting them high enough, right? If you're not sweating guarantees, and at that point, then what good is that guarantee doing if you're not sweating it ever, right? And then, two, if you do miss from time to time, now you get a reputation as being a place that misses, and that makes your room more attractive to players that are hoping when they decide to drive down to your room that day that that might be the day that you miss. So, you know, good managers don't fret the small misses. And in this scenario, I mean, I don't know what they were taking out, but, you know, if they weren't taking anything out, they were only down by 200. They're probably taking 20 out, so, you know, they're still down by 300. I mean, that's not a terrible big deal, I wouldn't think, and good advertising if they missed it. But so I don't think anything nefarious is going on, if that's what Vinny is suggesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can look at it from an ethical standpoint and say the guy knows, as the manager of the room, that he could put two people in that'll free roll, and they make a, you know, make an arrangement with the dealer and the manager who's playing and say, hey, I'll let you play this tournament for free, but any money you make, you know, we split with the company or some weird arrangement, because they're going to have to pay that $200 anyway, so why not put two people in and let them free roll in the tournament and then make a deal where you get that money back? You know, you give us a buy-in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That would be something I would be concerned about as a player.
Yeah, and that's probably what Vinny's kind of wondering about. That, to me, is wrong, because then you're just putting in players for free and making deals with them. Now you're undermining the actual players who are putting their own money. And you're, you know, so that's wrong. If they bought in with their own money, then it's right. So,
think about it this way. I'm like, they might have been, that just might be the thing. I was like, hey, you know, and we kind of do that with our dealers on the cruises, and we don't do guarantees, so this is never an issue. But, you know, we got a dealer that might want to play a tournament. We're like, you know, hey, we want our players to have a chance to get in first before you buy in.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we get close to the registration deadline and there's still a seat and you want to play, hey, that's more money in the prize pool. So that could have been the scenario here, too, where these folks wanted to play but didn't want to take seats from
Yeah.
Players, and then it got close to the end, and it just happened at the guarantee. I mean, those things could have been separate instances, right? Guarantee might not being met, and they're like, okay, it's time to get in, because we're not going to take a seat from one of our players. So
right.
All kinds of ways that this could be spun. So it just depends on asking good questions, and that's what I always tell people: ask the questions. Don't assume that something is going on that's uncomfortable. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, just feel free to go up after it and say, hey, you know, no big deal. I'm just asking. I'm like, you know, I saw two of your staff members buy into last minute. Were they using their money or the house money?
Yep.
It's your answer. So.
All right. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo director of poker, Elliot Schechter, tell you how he would have ruled. Our good friend Vic G in the house. He was playing 1-2 no limit at a Mississippi casino where he wasn't familiar with the house rules, like he is at his own poker room. On the river, he says, I pick up a small stack of 8 $5 chips, move my hand into the betting area, and cut out the first 4 chips. I'm doing all of this pretty slowly to gauge my lone opponent's reaction. This is when he impatiently pipes up and says, I'm calling whatever it is. Can I announce an amount above the $40 I'm holding? Can I announce all in? What I do know is that his verbal declaration is binding. Since my local poker room will only allow me to bet up to the amount in my hand, I release the remaining 4 chips to complete the $40 bet. He calls and I win the hand. After the hand ended, a player comments that since I was in the process of betting, I could have announced all in, and he would have been bound to call after making that statement. Other regulars chimed in, saying that I could only bet up to the $40 in my hand.
All right, Elliot says, congratulations on what appears to have been a successful and fruitful string bet. It was definitely closer to a string bet than the usual placing of 2 separate consecutive bets by one player. A string bet is defined as the placing of a wager in such a way that the other players cannot tell what the wager is because the bettor will not remove his hand from the betting area or announce an amount, and is usually done in an effort by the bettor to gain information that they otherwise wouldn't have had the betting that been done in a fair and timely manner. Your description of this situation comes pretty close to that definition. In any case, your ploy worked and your opponent acted out of turn with a conditional bet. At that point, it was still your turn. As you had not completed your bet, you would have been allowed to bet any amount you would have liked, and they would have been obligated to call that bet as a consequence of making a conditional bet out of turn.
Interesting.
I went back and forth with Vic about this for a while. So he took because that was my initial reaction. I was like, wow, Vic just string bet here. And so Vic's taken issue to that. So I want to be sure I clarify that he doesn't believe he was string betting. That this is what he's allowed to do in his home room is, you know, count out and then finish his bet before. I haven't seen that in a lot of places. So. And then we did go back and forth on these house rules on what betting you can do. I'm like, again, it sounds to me like a string bet, so no room allows that I know of. But you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you're trying to get some information, you're trying to gauge information by staggering your bet and however you do it. And it doesn't seem right to me, but the ruling is correct. You know, once that guy says, you know, hey, I'll call whatever. I mean, if you have not completed your bet, you can complete your bet now. So
I'm a little confused by it, though. Now, there are properties, and I've played in many of them, where whatever's in your hand, if it goes out toward the middle, not even past the betting line, which is almost always decorative unless they tell you it's not.
Right.
But the minute your hand moves forward with the chips in your hand, that's your bet unless you've announced something and then do it.
Exactly. Yep.
So the minute that it's in his hand, he's out there. One, I don't know how that's a string bet because the hand's out there as long as he's releasing all the chips.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
right.
$40 bet.
Right. For exactly. So now, also, now that he's put his hand out there with chips in his hand, and the guy's still going to call whatever you want, by him saying that I'm all in, that's a string bet to me because now he's bet with one hand and then gone back to his mouth for another one, another bet. So I don't see how he could be allowed to say now, because I haven't completed my bet, now I'm all in, when all the rules say that if you have chips in your hand, you didn't declare what you wanted to do, that the minute you move forward with those chips, that's the bet in your hand. Whether it comes from the hand and it's less than what's in your hand or not, it can't be more than what's in your hand. So I don't understand how he can now say all in and it counts.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what we're missing here is where the cards are. So, I mean, most rooms are when your chips pass your cards that are in play, whether they count them out or put them down or that. Yeah. Now, he says in here, moved him into the betting area or something like that. I don't know what he means by that. I don't know if that means that they're still behind his cards, or they're behind his cards, then that's a different story. If they're in front of his cards, yeah, you're right. I think at that point, I think most rooms would say, hey, you took that forward, that's your bet, and you're right. And you couldn't go back and say, oh, and after the player says that. But it's a little confusing.
Like you said, once he says, I moved my hand into the betting area, the word is betting, that means he's betting. So the fact that his hands are out there and he's got chips in them and he's in the place where everyone at that table recognizes, including that property, that he's in the area where he's making a bet, now that those chips are in his hand, that bet's there, he didn't say anything beforehand, so now he's got to make the bet from that hand. No matter what that guy says, he can't change his bet now. His bet's got to be what's in that hand. He can't just now verbally say, then I'm all in. No, you can't. Your hand is the bet now because it's in the betting area. That's the bet you're making. So it's a little confusing to me. I still don't understand the answer.
Well, yeah, I totally agree with you, but I guess what I'm saying is since they didn't make him do that, then maybe the confusion is Vic's describing what the betting area is, right? Maybe the dealer has a different opinion of what the betting area is than Vic does. So at that point, the dealer didn't make him bet the 40, let him count out four chips, stare the guy down, and then put the rest in because it wasn't, you know, in front of his cards, or they didn't consider it for emotion or whatever, all kinds of things, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the difficulty with these kind of submissions at hand of the week, right? You know, we're getting the impression from the person writing it in and not everybody else at the table, right?
I have an issue with Elliot's answer at the end. He says, in any case, your ploy worked and your opponent acted out of turn with a conditional bet. At that point, it's still your turn and you had not completed your bet. You would have been allowed to bet any amount you would have liked, and he would have been obligated to call. I don't see how he's still allowed to increase that bet when the hand is in the all-agreed-upon betting area and the chips are there. How does he add to that amount? I don't get it, because that would mean that he'd have to go back to his stack, or he'd have to say something that changes the bet that's in his hand to more than what's in his hand. I don't see how he's allowed to do that.
Yeah, so I guess what I'll finish with is that we always try to use these things to teach people the proper procedures. So two proper procedures here going forward that would have avoided this. One, don't announce I'll call whatever before the bet's made, because you're really putting yourself at risk. You know, I mean, even if it was exactly like you're describing, a Florida could rule differently for whatever reason, right? You never know. So never make that I'm calling whatever it is. That's one of the worst things you can ever say at the table unless you have the cold nuts. And then two, I'm like, you know, be careful with those chips where you're doing it, especially if you're moving the different rooms. One of the things I told Vic is, you know, some rooms just are not well run, right? I mean, let's be honest. Some rooms are really well run. I mean, it's like a bell curve on anything else, right? Yeah. So if you happen to be, and I'm not saying this is the case here, but if you happen to be playing in a room that's just not well run, that allows procedures that are not recommended by other rooms or followed by other rooms, and then you go to a different room and you try to do that, you could be in trouble. So, we go back to like the ABCs, you know, verbalize your bet. Hey, I bet 40. Of course, in this case, that's not what Vic wanted. Vic wanted to bet 20 and get to read and then bet the other 20, which we can debate that all day long. But you're much better off verbalizing your bet or only taking the chips in your hand that you wish to bet, and all those things, then you don't have to worry. You don't have to worry about it.
So. We have a new O'Malley's move. Here it comes.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're playing $1, $2, No Limit Hold'em at our regular casino. This game has a mix of loose aggressive and tight aggressive players, but not many solid players, and there is a lot of limping pre-flop. We haven't been playing for long, and currently sit with 235. We post our small blind, the big blind posts, the under-the-gun limps, and MP limps, the cutoff, and the button limp. Action is to us, and we look down at the Jack of Hearts, Jack of Clubs. This hand isn't one that I want to limp with, but being in the small blind with that many limpers is some cause for concern. I'm going to raise here, but I'd like to make that raise on the larger side. I don't want to be out of position in a multi-way pot. We make it $20 to go. We're going to be out of position in a multi-way pot anyway, because all of the limpers, including the big blind, call. The pot is around 120, and the flop is the king of spades, king of diamonds, five of diamonds. This isn't a terrible flop for our hand, but with five remaining opponents holding a total of 10 cards between them, there's a high likelihood that one of them has a king. We check, and it gets checked around to the button. The button has us covered and is a loose aggressive player who makes an interesting move here. He bets $31 into the $120 pot. So, it's back on us, and we're facing a one-quarter pot bet. What's the move?
It's time for the AdvancedPokerTraining.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at AntiUpMagazine.com. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. Ed Rindler is back, Chris, and he's got two hands here. We're only going to do one, but I'm going to give you a little preview that will help us as we go through the second hand. So,
okay.
He says he hasn't had time to play in a real poker game since November. When I played in an eight-game home mix tournament until last Friday. I wonder if it's the Atlanta's eight-game mix. A little razz-doogie going on there. He says, boy, I was rusty. I played in a home game again with many of my same regulars, but a few different people I had never played with before in a $30 no-limit hold'em tournament. The group has regular games every Friday, mixing in tournaments they play from week to week. Since I can only get my regular group to play hold'em, I try to play with this group to get some of the other games. They play with TDA rules in mind, and their goal is to, one, have a good time, and two, to help learn all the possible games. Yeah, sounds like our home game. I have played four tournaments with them, and there have been three who play every time, and they're all solid players with good knowledge of the games they play. Let's see. First hand of the tournament, I was in a big blind with six spades, seven of hearts, and folded after a hijack raise, button call, and small blind call because I do not like to play the first hand of the tournament. Flop came 6, 7, 10, and I thought, here we go. Turn was another 6 immediately, and I'm kicking myself for sticking to my normal routine because hijack and small blind are bet raise calling both streets. Then the river was an ace, which showed it to be a bet call, and the hijack turned over ace-ace, and the small blind had queen-queen. I was glad I folded my first hand because nothing is worse than driving an hour, paying $30, and getting busted on the first hand. All right, so let's see. Second hand, he says, this hand happens. Let's see, all right. Blinds are 5,100, and we have the squeakly 20K starting the hand, and we're in the hijack. All right. So blinds 5,100, squeakly 20K starting stack still, and we're in the hijack.
Okay.
Under the gun plus one, who is shown to be a loose, aggressive player, raising a lot of pots and c-betting regularly, and has also been caught bluffing twice on the river and has won a couple pots on the river as well, raises to 350. It folds to us with the ace of spades, five of spades.
Of course he has ace of spades on this show. let's see.
Motorhead.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is not really a good hand. I mean, I guess it really depends on... You know, I mean, you're in the hijack. You still have a cutoff and a button behind you who might do a squeeze now if you call this, and it's not a great hand. The suited ace is not a great hand when it's wheel cards. You know what I mean? It's okay, but if anything, I'm going to want to do something different and, you know, re-raise or something because I'm not going to limp with an ace five and then have somebody – depends on the people behind me. I don't know if they're aggressive. You know, if they are, you might have the button guy who just says, you know what? Oh, there's a guy. If he had a real hand, he would have really, you know, re-raised here. So he didn't. So I'm going to squeeze these guys and bet 1,500 and watch them all fall down. And I've wasted 350. So generally, if I get a feel for the table and I know I can get away with a limp, maybe I will. But normally, if I'm going to play this hand, I'm going to want to isolate somebody and make it seem like I have a better hand than I do, and I'm going to re-raise. So I don't know. Generally, I just fold these hands in a tournament like this, but I'm not saying it's too passive, too weak, or whatever. But I don't know. I don't really like this hand, but if I do play it, I want to play it for a raise and see what this guy does, and see. And I can start to. Usually, at these stages of tournaments, I like to see what people play like, and I want to know. Maybe I use this as information when it's cheap enough for me to make it, you know, 1,200 or 1,000. And see what this guy does when he's faced with a re-raise when he decides to raise fairly early, you know, under the gun plus one. So I don't know. I could do a lot of things with this hand, but generally I just let it go in a tournament.
Yeah, I can make a case for all three here. So my case for raising would be that this player seems to be our initial raiser here seems to be playing pretty loose, right? So you need to kind of taper him down a little bit by raising from time to time and throwing him off his game. The reason I don't like that is it's early in the tournament, and I don't see any reason to get into a big pot with a hand that's not fantastic. Now, I do like that the fact that they're wheel cards rather than A6 or A7, but it doesn't make it terribly stronger either, though, so I would rather not get into that mix. I would tend to call here just because it's so early in the tournament. The 350 doesn't cost me anything. I've got a hand that can flop big or I can get out pretty easily. So that's probably where I'd lean. I could also argue that that's kind of weak because of why we just mentioned you should raise. So, and then folding, again, it's again not a fantastic hand. We don't have the best position for it. And it's early, and we can still watch the hand play out, right? You know, unless this guy, if it folds out, then we won't see it. So we don't have to put money into a pot to figure out how people play. So that would be the case for folding. But this early in the tournament, I kind of like to, when I got a hand that can flop big and the bet's not that big, I'm more inclined to call and see what happens and be cautious. But so that's me.
Yeah, if I just get some sort of inkling that the guys behind us aren't super aggressive, I don't mind limping along. I might even end up being in position in this hand, you know, and a suited ace could make the nut hand, you know, and then it's wheel cards. You could make a weird wheel, 2-3-4. Of course, somebody could have 5-6, especially the guy who's loose, you know, you never know. But yeah, if I'm being fair and honest with this, if I have 20,000 chips in front of me and I know the guys at the table are pretty passive, I'm probably limping along here. But if it's an aggressive table where the guys behind me are 3 and 4 betting a lot and stuff like that, or I'm just letting it go and I'll be like, I'll choose my moments later.
Change things. Absolutely. I don't want to put more than 350 in the pot on this. So if I felt a higher than normal, probability that somebody behind was going to pop it again, then I'm not going to waste my 350. Cause then again, you're back to what we talked about. You're still going to get to see the hand play out and there's no reason to invest your own money in it.
Yep.
All right. Our hero calls and he says, based on his opponent's tendency to play a lot of hands and the big blind also calls. So 3 to the flop with 1100 in the pot. Flop is the ace of hearts, deuce of clubs, tray of hearts. The initial raiser bets 325 and it's on us.
Yeah. See, this is what you're afraid of. When we say flop big, we're not talking about an aces. We're talking about nut flush draw, nut flush, two pair, trip five, something like that that they can't put you on. In this case, while we know the guy's loose, it doesn't mean he's loose every single time he plays a hand. And generally, when you're under the gun or under the gun plus one, you're playing a hand like ace, queen, ace, king, ace, jack, and the kicker is going to beat us. Now, could he have kings? Could he have queens? Yeah. Could he have nothing? Yeah. It's tough. I think I want my answer now rather than later. I don't know if I can just get away with just calling. I'm just going to be bleeding chips. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I mean, to me, you have a wheel draw here. We don't have any chance of a backdoor flush. So, I mean, you have aces with the worst kicker possible, basically, except for a four. I don't know. I mean, one guy, jeez. I don't know. So I'm assuming it checked to this under the gun plus one, right? Because there was a blind in here somewhere. So that guy probably didn't hit the hand. So we're probably going to be heads up.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't mention it, but yeah, I would assume the big blind handle, but check. But.
So I feel like we might be heads up. So I might just call and see what happens on the turn. It's not that much money still. Raising really doesn't, you know, if I make it at 1,200 and the guy shoves, I've lost 1,200 for no reason. I can still hit my wheel on the turn. So I'll probably call and see if I improve. I could hit a five, you know, and make aces up. So if another ace comes, I might be more inclined to think that I have the best hand now and he doesn't really have an ace with a big kicker. Not that it's not true. It happens all the time in the case ace comes, but I'm just saying my thinking pattern. So I'll probably call You know, if I raise, I'm probably wasting money. The guy might shove on me and or whatever, and then I'm like, all right, I got to throw this away now with ace five. Shouldn't even gotten involved in the first place. And now that I have gotten involved, you know, I didn't play it the right way. I feel like a call is probably in order.
Yeah, all right. So I think we can eliminate fold from our options. So it's really a call or raise. And again, I can make an argument for both. So the raise, what I like is that we have that wheel draw. Now, again, it's a gut shot, so only four cards can help us. But we do have a little bit more protection there to kind of play back at this player and find out whether he's just his normal loose player or whether he actually has a hand now. So. And then in a normal scenario, this also gives you that free card to hit on the river, you know, assuming that if you raise here, he calls, he checks to you, then you could check behind again on the turn and get that free card to hit if you want or keep the pressure up. So it gives you a couple options there. And then calling, I think you're right. I'm like, you know, I don't necessarily think this guy's going to shove 20,000 here if we raise it to 1,000, but you never know. But I don't want to have a three bet back to us right. With the ace, bad kicker, and a gut shot going on. So yeah, I could go either way with this. Definitely not folding. I think again early in this tournament, I usually like to let these people hang themselves. So I'm more inclined probably to call here, and you know, hope I hit my four, even my five. I'd be comfortable with. I can't imagine I can't put this guy on a four of any reason. So you know, I really got eight cards that are really going to help me. And maybe the aces, depending on what we think he has. So I'm probably more likely going to call early on to just to kind of get more information out of this hand. So
I will say this: if I hit my gin card on the turn, I will put the hammer down because there's hearts out there, and I don't want this guy to. He's just an loose aggressive player. He'd be playing any suited cards. You know, for all we know, he's got jack ten of hearts now, and he's not going to go anywhere or something. So. If a turn card gets there for me where it's aces up and it's non-heart, then I'm putting the hammer down. If it's a heart, then I might even, you know, I'm going to be careful. But I might even be done with this hand. If it's, you know, if it's a four of hearts, I'm not going to be as happy about it as possible. But if I hit something like the four of clubs, you know, or even if I hit my five of clubs, you know, I'm going to put the hammer down on the turn. Big bet.
All right, our hero calls on the big blind folds, so we're heads up now. He says, I'm thinking I probably hit better than him. I have a gut shot. I notice that you usually see bets, but when call checks the turn, so I think I can get a free card. All right, well, that's interesting information. If that's what he normally does, that eliminates the whole reason we needed to raise there. You know, if we could still get the free card without having to raise, that's a freer card. So that makes it all more reason that I would call here. So I guess we'll see what happens. Turn is the four of spades. So our board now is ace of hearts, deuce of clubs, tray of hearts, four of spades, and it is checked to us.
Wow. All right, so we hit our wheel. No flush got there yet. And there was 11 in the pot before that. Bet 325, so that's 650. So there's 1750 in the pot. Yeah, you know, what's interesting is if this guy has, like, ace-king or something now, and we make a really big bet, he's going to think we're trying to steal it, maybe. This is when I bet, like, pot, you know?
Yeah, I think I might even go, like, 2K.
Like, 2K, exactly. And just to make him think, oh, this guy is afraid of, you know, or he's trying to protect his hand, but I have ace-king, and or maybe if he has a big ace, now you've got him because you got the wheel. He'll never suspect the wheel here.
Plus, you price him out of the flush draw. I mean, it doesn't mean he's going to fold. Certainly in the tournament, people forget those odds anyhow. But at least you're making him make a mistake if he calls with just hearts, which is always a good thing.
Yeah.
Then you're almost inviting that call. So or making that call correct, I should say, not inviting it. But yeah.
We agree. 2K is a good bet, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Our hero bets 1,000, and opponent calls. River is the six of hearts, so our final board is the ace of hearts, deuce of clubs, tray of hearts, four of spades, six of hearts, and our opponent checks to us again. This is a check down here.
I know it's going to be weak. They're going to be like, how could you check the wheel when the guy turns over ace king or something? But at the same time, it's like he could have hearts. He could even have 5-7 for all we know, you know? 5-7 of hearts or something, you know? Who knows? So, Yeah, I don't know. I feel weak checking, but
play more aggressively later in the tournament when blinds are increasing and your number of big blinds is less. Here, we're so deep here right now. I mean, and the way I look at it, I'm like, I really shouldn't have won anything with an ace five hand. And if I now it's now what, 3,000 in the pot. You know, check behind, take that 3,000, be happy. If I bet and then get raised, what am I going to do then?
Yeah, if the guy's check raising, the intent of check raising us with the hearts.
Kind of tough to throw away a straight here, but now the hearts got there, and then we don't have the best straight. And we didn't have the best straight to begin with, but now it's, you know,
loose
player could be playing 5-7. So I don't know. I just would rather not have to put myself to another test here. I'm like, you know, he gave us an option of getting out of this hand cheaply. And I'm going to do it and take that 3,000 and be happy with it, I think. So, you know, if that's weak, that's weak. But I don't know what happens if we bet here and then we get raised or raised big.
It's interesting because if you're the guy with the flush now, if you have a flush, do you really want to let this guy off the hook and miss an opportunity to bet? So the fact that he checked is even more scary to me. That, I mean, I feel like I should, if I were in this moment, I think I would be betting. Because if you had the flush, do you really want to miss the chance of me checking behind? Because when you called my bet on the turn, now I might be thinking, all right, you called, so you don't have that great of a hand. To me, that check would make me want to bet. You know, I feel like if I'm at the table, I'm saying to myself, you know what? He didn't raise me on the turn, so he's a little skeptical too. So now I want to milk it for all I can, and I'm going to put in a value bet here with my straight. But because it's hand of the week, we're so inclined to say, "Oh, three hearts got there. We have to fold. We have to check behind now." Because we're, you know what I mean? We can't put him on 5-7. I can't put him on two hearts. But wouldn't, since he's aggressive and everything, wouldn't he want to make like a big bet here to make it look like, oh, this is the guy that's aggressive and he's trying to steal it from us in the end because he missed whatever, or because he's afraid of what we're going to, you know, I feel like that check, if I was in the moment, would make me want to bet. And I'm saying not to bet now because it's hand of the week, but I feel like if I'm being completely honest, I would bet here in a real tournament now. And that makes me nervous because it's hand of the week, and hand of the week means check raise, he's got the nut flush, you know, or some crap like that. So,
yeah, where this gets tricky, I think, is, you know, you think if this guy did hit his hearts here, there'd be no reason for him not to bet the river because he doesn't want to lose the value. You know, if you're not going to call, you're not going to call anyhow. But, you know, you got to bet your own hand, right? So that's normally how it would play out. But we also know that players don't play the way they should play, and a lot of players look for these check raise opportunities and then get all upset. Like, oh, I was hoping you were going to bet. I'm like, how many times has that happened? I'm like, nope, sorry, I'm not going to bet your hand. And they turn over the flush and they take it. So, I mean, it's almost impossible to figure out where he's at this point based on this, how everything went down. And knowing he can be a little crazy and stuff. I mean, again, I think the safest bet is the check here. Hope to rake in that 3,100. If he beat me, then that's great. Then I save money because he's obviously going to call whatever I bet. I don't think I'm giving up that much value this early in the tournament by checking here.
Yeah. All right, let's check.
All right, our hero bets 2,500, and our opponent raises all in to 5,700.
Oh, jeez. Well, we have to call. We're hoping he has the same straight as us now, to be honest, because we've got so much invested. We still started with 20K, so to call another 25, 26, 2700 or whatever.
Super
whatever.
Deep. I mean, it just kind of sucks. This is what we were worried about. So, I mean, unless we win this, then it's great. But knowing that that was the chip stack, which, you know, I don't think we knew his chip stack going into this. So that changes things a little bit. I'm not as worried about that bet now. If I know the most I was going to put in here is another 8,200, right? When I started 20, and so, you know, you never like to lose half your stack on a hand, but when you're at 5,100 and you still have 10,000, that you get a lot of play there. So, I have a feeling I'm behind here, but, it's a weird check raise. So I think I have to call it.
Yeah. It's terrible. You have to call this. I can't lay it down though. Hope he doesn't have hearts.
All right, our hero says, as I play the hand in my head again, I notice the three hearts. I start to think, what hands play this way? One, a flush plays this way. Bet pre-c-bet post with a draw, call the turn and get there on the river. Two, a bluff. Then I think about what I've seen this guy show down. He's shown down top pair in spots where it didn't make sense to be good. He has shown a set. He has shown ace high, and I cannot place him on a hand. I tell the table I'm sorry for taking so long, but if I would not have bet the river, I would not have been in the spot. There we go. Bingo.
Yeah.
I ultimately make in my mind a horrible call with the justification in my mind that I still have almost the initial starting stack left if I'm wrong. He turns over the king of hearts, five of hearts for the nut flush, and apologizes.
So he had the straight and the flush.
He says, the thought of it being the wrong call is not results-oriented. I feel even if I caught a bluff there, I made the wrong call. But I think if I played more, I would have seen the flush and not bet the river. Yep, I think that was the big mistake.
Yeah.
Also, I wonder if I should have re-raised pre since he was so aggressive throughout. Maybe a 3-bet gets him out or allows me a better idea what he plays there. No, a 3-bet, this kind of player is not going to go anywhere for a 3-bet with king five of hearts. You know, most players would be, but... I don't think that would have changed. And we already talked about why that was probably not the best play, though it was a viable play to re-raise pre-flop.
Right.
Big thing, though, was making sure the straight and river, I mean, the flush was on the river there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've been trying to work on, because I kind of get impatient, I'm normally an impatient person in general, and certainly at the table, is that I do tend to miss those kind of things, especially playing Omaha. I mean, I can't tell you that this last trip to Atlantis, there are like two hands where I misread my hand, turned them over, and the dealer fortunately read them correctly, and I had a better hand than I thought.
Oh, wow.
One of them, I actually won the pot that I thought I lost. The other one, I just won it better than I had. So, you know, one of the things I'm starting to do when I'm not in the hand, and I need to start doing it more when I'm in the hand, and certainly Ed would benefit from this too, is every time when the flop comes down, look at the board and what's the nuts of that board.
Yeah.
Especially in Omaha 8, it's really good to know, because now you're looking at both the low and the high, and it keeps you trained on, I'm like, okay, oh, wait, now the board's paired. I didn't see the board paired. Or, oh, there's three hearts there. I didn't see the three hearts. And then, you know, just, you might play a little more scared that way, but you're playing with the right information. Whereas here we were playing with the wrong information and it cost us, you know, if we had saw the hearts, we would have checked and we would have saved $8,200 or 8,200 chips. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Ed, but you made the show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Anti-Up is a production of AntiUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AntiUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AntiUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.